Watching Sia or Everest help Teddy walk, Krishna wanted to help too. This ragtag procession broke my heart, but was at times also comical, as we tried both to keep Krishna out of the way and to let her feel a part of all the activity. Everest was the preferred choice for Teddy to lean on, and so Sia and I usually trailed slightly behind, steadying the IV pole and hoping neither Teddy nor Krishna would trip or fall over each other. One early evening, I looked outside at the tall, reedy grass growing between the house and the ocean. The sun was setting. The already tan stalks glowed golden in the last light of the day, and I could hear the sea over the television. The tall shrubs swayed and rubbed against one another, rustling in the sea wind. The wet aroma of tomatoes simmering in the kitchen hung in the air like a warm cloak. Maggie, Teddy's cook, was stewing up a cauldron of the last of the late summer tomatoes. My stomach grumbled. Now and then I could hear a yelp or a whoop from the front of the house, where Everest and Sia were playing a rare game of tennis. The baby played at our feet with some blocks. Teddy said he had just been remembering a dinner we had attended together, but that the memory didn't make sense. He didn't know why. He didn't know what he was saying exactly, but he knew enough to know that his brain was playing tricks on him. It worried him. He thought that what he remembered happening hadn't happened. He was right. The memory was a jumble of memories conflated into one. He had overlapped separate events and did not know how to untangle them. He didn't know what was true and what was his mind short-circuiting. He said there had been a dinner or a big banquet, and it looked like I was shooting Top Chef, but he was there too. And for some reason, the chef Danielle Ballou was with us. All three things he remembered were a plausible combination. Teddy did throw a big charity dinner around that time every year called Huggy Bear. But this was not a Huggy Bear dinner, he said. And he knew Danielle well, too. Teddy dined often at Café Ballou, which was coincidentally in the lobby of the Surrey Hotel, for years with his mother, and then with me. We dined at the restaurant Danielle on special occasions, too. I had arranged his 70th birthday dinner there, a week before Krishna was born. Teddy loved the steak, and when he got too sick to eat out, Danielle sweetly sent ribeye and potatoes home to the Manhattan apartment with the driver. Teddy had also visited me on the set many times, but never for a big event or banquet. He knew all this, but he still had trouble sorting through what was real and what was imagined. The confusion. He could not tell the subtle but important difference between possibility and actual memory. That was the first time he noticed being confused. It scared us both. Losing his mental faculties was his worst nightmare. I felt the evening chill creep into me and reached for a nearby blanket. "Summer is almost over," I said, trying to change the subject. "So am I," his eyes seemed to be saying back. Sometime after my 41st birthday, on September 1st, back in the city, I was still trying to jumpstart Teddy's appetite. I wrapped Krishna up into my baby Bjorn, although she was getting heavy by this time, and went to the farmer's market in Union Square, hunting for goodies. A trip to the green market always gave me a sense of well-being and elevated my mood. It was a favorite outing for Krishna, too. She loved all the hustle and bustle of the vendors and the motley crew that passed through, the dreadlocked skateboarders whizzing by, the flowers she stuck her nose right into on days when we went with the stroller, and the piles and piles of fruits, vegetables, cheeses, and breads, and other baked treats heaped on every stall. It was my favorite time of year, the hinge moment between seasons, between the full bloom of summer and the chill of fall creeping in slowly. Krishna enjoyed touching and fingering all the different colored vegetables like spiky, spiraled neon green Romanesco, yellow and purple corn with their soft silk sprouting at the top, nubby sweet potatoes, fuzzy peaches, and juicy plums. She ate blueberries by the handful and loved the crisp bite of sliced Asian pear. And she was a good sport about trying every strange nugget of cheese that was offered. All the vendors were more than generous with their samples, waving them in front of her nose. She dangled from my torso facing outward, eager to taste the world she had yet to discover. The market was exhilarating, a bountiful place to exercise her senses. The chemo made Teddy quite debilitated and nauseous, and the thrush that came with it coated his taste buds like a blanket of snow covering spring grass. Even the Marinol pills did little to restore his interest in food. Teddy's appetite had been decreasing by the day, and I could think of nothing as nourishing as a white ragu made with veal and mushrooms that he loved. He had eaten a similar version almost weekly across the street from his office at Cipriani in the Sherry Netherland Hotel. I found some lovely hen-of-the-woods mushrooms and some trumpets, too. I bought fresh dill and other tender herbs for my favorite stall, which also had at this time what I considered to be the jewels of the farmer's market, chili peppers. Hot, hotter, and the hottest chili peppers, in bright red, dark green, marigold yellow, and purple black, as well as fluorescent orange. All spring and well into the end of summer, this stall was one of the biggest in the market, consisting of a horseshoe of three tables with lanes of tables in the middle. Behind the back wall of tables, hanging from the tent covering, was a chart listing the different kinds of peppers and their supposed numerical rating on the Scoville scale. This stall, laden with these riches, was what I looked forward to most. I disregarded the famous measure of capsaicin, the substance that provides spicy heat, in each of the peppers, and preferred to sample them on my own, usually with a bit of bread and cheese in hand, to quell the sting between bites. I bought a handful of Scotch bonnets, about a cup of green and red small Thai chilies for cooking, and a heavy cellophane bag of round red cherry peppers the size of ping-pong balls. I always bought a random sampling of ones I was curious about, mostly for their physical beauty. I made sure to get a decent bag of mild chilies for Krishna's sake. She could not resist getting in on the action. I had to fend off her arms, outstretched inside mine, trying to touch every colorful and dangerous little bomb as I bent forward. I usually made her hold the hunk of bread, and she would gnaw on it, soaking it with her saliva. These peppers were not for Teddy. He never liked his food very spicy, even at his healthiest. These peppers were not for Krishna. Most were way too hot, even if she did eat much more spicier food than others her age. These peppers were for me, I suppose, to quell the impending grief. Shiny and ready to unleash their power into some otherwise bland dish. One of my favorite pastimes was to bring home a big haul of different peppers and experiment, making up new chutneys or blending them with fruits like green apple or hard green plums for a sweet and sour relish. My mother has always been the condiment queen of our family, whipping up sauces in her blender or with her mortar and pestle, with magic in her hands. She could turn any boring lunch or dinner into an intensely tantalizing experience of hot and sweet and sour flavors exploding in your mouth at once by just adding a sauce or relish on the side. I had inherited the same itch, if not yet honed a subtlety of palate like hers. I liked the jagged spike of fresh salsas and the mellow depth of slow-cooked chutneys too. But in those days, what I was most interested in was pickling. I had been around the grand ritual of pickle-making when I was young, of course, in my grandmother's home. and when we first moved to Los Angeles and stayed with my uncle Bharat, my mother made many pickles with the citrus in their backyard. But those were Indian pickles. They were very complicated to make and often perfumed up the house for days with the aroma of mustard oil and frying spices. Some Indian pickles have a laundry list of ingredients that runs for miles, including many you could never even taste anyway. My foremothers assured me that every ingredient was essential, whether I knew why or not, and considering the heat of the chilies involved, nothing should be omitted, because you needed these ingredients to buffer the stomach. Regardless, all that alchemy and the array of items to achieve it were not in the cards at that strange juncture of my life. What I got very interested in was simple preservation. Pickling is a great activity. It requires very few ingredients beside the vegetable you are actually pickling. A handful of seeds, herbs, and twigs thrown into salted vinegar and you're in business. Simply submerging your favorite vegetables or early fall chilies in liquid and seasonings takes mere minutes and bestows months of good bottled heat in the dead of winter. Krishna immediately fell in love with pickling. Pickles were the first thing we made together. She had seen me add pickled chili peppers to countless dishes. She was fascinated by the ceremony of it. We filled the lids of spice bottles with coriander seeds, oregano, and black peppercorns, arranging them in an assembly line on the counter. Then I poured clear vinegar into a large pickling jar, adding enough salt and a healthy pinch of sugar. It delighted her to see these dissolve, disappearing with every stir of her wooden spoon like magic. She tried not to stir too swiftly while I coarsely sliced some onions and carrots on the bias. We added the spices to the jar, one by one. She loved to watch them swirl around, sticking her little fingers into the cold vinegar to taste. We tossed the cherry peppers with the other vegetables into a bowl, and she mixed them with her hands too. While I tried to gently plop them into the jar, she laughed, plunging her whole hands into the salty vinegar. There was so much tactile pleasure in pickle making, and little she couldn't participate in. It gave her a deep sense of pride to display the bottles on our counter, which was right opposite the front door. Whenever a new person entered the house, she would indicate that she had made them herself by running over to where they were and pointing upward, saying, "Look at my pickles! I made pickles!" She kept asking when they would be ready, the glowing red orbs in ever-amber-colored water. That they were most likely too hot, and she would never be able to eat them herself, did not curtail her suspense and anticipation. I kept telling her they wouldn't be ready for months, because at first she would look at them every day, shaking them at the base with both hands in such a way I feared they would slide off and come crashing down over her head. "When, Mama, when?" "When it gets really cold, and you wear the heavy coat for the snow," I said. It occurred to me then that by the time I took my first bite of these pickles, so lovingly made and impatiently waited for by Krishna, Teddy might not be around. I wanted the next days to go slowly, as much as Krishna wanted them to speed up. Outside our window, I saw the first leaf fall from the maple tree, turning and swirling hopelessly, toward its death on the ground below. It was almost Halloween. Krishna was a lion. She had a costume that looked exactly like a child-sized replica of the cowardly lion in The Wizard of Oz. It was the perfect costume, furry and soft and warm. Her rosy cheeks and dimpled chin smiled from ear to ear with self-satisfaction. Teddy had been sleeping a lot that weekend since we got to the house on Meadow Lane. He hadn't been up at all since going to bed early the evening before, but he could feel me in the bed with him. He held and squeezed my hand when I slipped it into his. he interlaced his fingers with mine. He was pretty weak then. He had to use the wheelchair at all times, and he hated it. And he was thin, so very thin. When I turned to hug him, pressing my body up against his back, I could feel his ribs on my breasts, the bones of his arm and shoulder, even his tailbone and pelvis against my front. Krishna and I had gone apple picking with Maggie down Route 27, and I was making applesauce for her and Teddy with lots and lots of cinnamon and butter. Teddy loved cinnamon. He had it in his coffee every day. But he no longer drank coffee. When the thrush and chemo made his throat sore, it became hard for him to swallow. He began to choke on simple soft roast chicken. He just couldn't be bothered to chew, either. But I knew he loved my applesauce. It was warm and wet and sweet. It would go down if anything could. Krishna loved it, too. It was her favorite, neck and neck with Tata's banana paisum. The house smelled of brown butter and cinnamon and stewed apples. There was enough, so Maggie and I put some in containers to cool on the counter, and even a portion for us to take back to the city. There was a definite chill already, and the autumn leaves were rustling in the wind from the sea. None of us had walked on the beach for quite a while. It was too cold. I hoped what was bubbling on the stove would keep us all warm. Judy was there, too. Judy doted on Krishna, and Krishna loved her. They even shared the same birthday, and they had similar dispositions. Judy had brought Krishna a set of fairy wings that were delicate, gauzy, and pink, with a wand and crown, and they delighted Krishna. I also got her a mail-order white tiger costume, which was for indoors. We had just seen a live white tiger at the Ringling Brothers Circus, also named Krishna, while I was filming the show in Texas that summer, so she had wanted to be that for Halloween. But I couldn't resist getting the lion. It would keep her warm on its own if she went trick-or-treating outdoors. She looked fantastic in all of them. The late afternoon sun was getting low. Krishna wanted to show her Poppy her Halloween getup, and she wouldn't accept that he could not be awakened to look at it. The bed was almost as tall as she was, but she had recently learned to wedge her toes deep into the crevice between the box spring and the mattress to hoist herself up. She sometimes pulled on a sheet for leverage, though at times she pulled on Teddy. I walked in and saw this small brown animal creep up and startle poor Teddy, who let out a low groan.
"Poppy, wake up! Wake up now, Poppy!"
She had been waiting patiently way past lunch, and now she couldn't stand it any longer. I was afraid she would hurt him or herself. I came up from behind and carried her up into the bed. I told her to be very careful because Poppy wasn't feeling very strong. Teddy had some random purplish bruises on his forearm from all the treatments, and I pointed them out to Krishna to always be careful where she grabbed Poppy. She was so used to being rough with him, to just climbing all over him at will. I put her carefully on my side of the bed next to him. He happened to be turned inward toward where I would normally sleep. She was as careful as it's possible for a toddler under two to be. I was moved by how her little hand rubbed his forearm. She put her face up close to his, as much as the woolly mane would allow her to.
"Poppy, wake up! Look, I'm a lion!"
I lay down on the other side of Krishna to make sure I could buffer any sudden movements she made. The remaining hair that was not shaved off on the side of Teddy's head had been shorn to a very short quarter inch of salt and pepper stubble, and it made him look strangely like a little boy sleeping with his hands under his stubbled chin. He did not open his eyes.
"Mmm,"
he moaned, clearly disturbed.
"Poppy, I'm a scary lion. Argh!"
Her Poppy was not getting up.
Poppy, Poppy, get up.
She squealed right into his face. Let him sleep, Ganna. I tried to gently pull her away by the waist.
Just open your eyes, she cajoled. Open. Poppy, see?
I didn't know then that it would be the last exchange between Krishna and her Poppy. But what I saw scared me. Hey, if you can hear us, Teddy, blink, I said quietly. He did not blink. But then, the corner of his mouth turned up ever so slightly, and then he slowly opened his eyes and shut them again rapidly, as if to say, not there yet, Junior. Without opening them again, he said, hey, kiddo. Now Krishna became emboldened and lunged her face back closer to his.
Look, I'm a lion.
You are a lion.
You're not looking,
she accused. Teddy, with great effort, opened his eyes again. They stared at each other for what seemed like a very long time. All I could hear was Teddy's breathing, slow and heavy. Krishna couldn't stand the silence.
I love you, Poppy. Oh, yes, I do.
It was from a song we always sang to him. Teddy closed his eyes. I love you too, kiddo. Have fun. Before he could finish, she was already scrambling down the wooden bench at the foot of the bed. From there, she could make it to the ground easily. She scampered off to find Judy or Maggie or maybe Maggie's husband, Matthew. I stayed there for a few minutes and moved closer to Teddy and tried to put my arm around his waist. But after a few seconds, felt the weight of my arm itself was too much on his torso.
You okay? I asked him.
Yeah, just tired. She's a lion. That night would be the last night Teddy and I would sleep in that house together, or share any bed ever again. It was very early in the morning of November 20 when the call came. So early that it was still dark in the bedroom, with not even a sliver of light peeking through the space between wall and window shade. Krishna shifted slightly at the first ring, but the soft rumble of her nostrils did not break the sleepy rhythm of light snoring. She had woken up a few hours before, crying out. I managed to pat her back to sleep. I thought then that she'd had a bad dream. By the second ring, I was out of bed. When I got to the phone, charging in the kitchen, the ringing had stopped. Bleary-eyed but awake, somehow I knew. He was no more. The night had been uneasy from the start. After a supper of peas, carrots, and rice noodles, Krishna and I got into the bath later than usual. I could feel her bum bouncing on my thigh as I soaped her neck and shoulders. Along with the yellow duckies and other tub toys, a few noodles and peas bobbed in the soapy water, stowaways in the many folds of her belly. I washed her hair with one hand as I fished for the stray pea, the odd noodle, with the other. I ladled water over her head with a plastic mug. As I washed her, an alarm began to ring in my head, faint at first, then louder and louder. I felt fingers scratch at my torso. I looked down to see my heartbeat pulsing visibly, wildly, and the open mouth reaching for a nipple. I parried her attempt, guiding her lips away.
I want, she whimpered.
I had already weaned her, but she still wanted her way. I needed to find my phone. No more mommy's milk, Anna, I said, spinning her slippery frame to face forward, then pulling the drain. I got out of the bath and reached for my phone, my hand dripping and now shaking. I dialed his home. Cursorily wrapped in a towel, I stood in the doorway, watching her in the tub. Hi, Padma. His housekeeper, Sandy, answered before I'd spoken. My throat tight, I asked if everything was okay. If I should just bundle the baby and come over. A cab, the FDR, I could be there in 10 minutes. Something was wrong. I could feel it.
They are up there with him, she said, referring to his siblings, who had by then come in and taken over his care in the very last stages of his illness. Let me check.
I had dressed by the time I heard Sandy's voice again. Water from my hair dripped down my spine beneath the sweater. I kept my eye trained on Krishna's glistening back as she sat in the now empty tub with her toys strewn around her, humming softly and coloring with bath crayons on her newly enlarged canvas. Two ducks run aground were nestled against her lower back, beak to beak, as if kissing. How strange this looks, I thought. How arranged.
They said to tell you there's no change.
I had known Sandy for more than 4 years by then, and could tell any emotion or how tired she was by the strain in her Bosnian accent. The next time Sandy and I would speak would be at the Frank E. Campbell funeral home. Early the next morning, after I'd felt my way in the dark to the phone, I saw who had called. I took the phone to the living room and sat down on the green velvet couch. I dialed his sister's number for confirmation, though I needed none. She wouldn't tell me the exact time of death. But I knew when in the middle of the night he had chosen to go. Even the baby had. It seemed she had woken up to say goodbye. I couldn't go back into the bedroom. I couldn't bear to lie down next to her, my body now filled with this irrevocable information. I wanted her to continue sleeping in a world that still contained her Poppy, for as long as she could. For months, I had known this day would come, from the moment 7.5 months prior, when the surgeon, still in his scrubs, had told me and Teddy's children of the large, voracious tumor in his brain. Throughout the sweet heartbreak of watching Krishna learn the names of his nurses, seeing her gradually grasp the purpose of the IV they tended, which, as she put it, was meant to cure the big boo-boo in Poppy's head. Still, despite my almost daily rehearsal of the inevitable, the event itself, the blow to the gut, was no less startling than if his plane had fallen out of the sky. When I heard the news, for a moment I saw my life, without him, the many lonely years ahead of me. I sat motionless until a wave of grief toppled me sideways, and my tears soaked the couch. Sometime later, dawn broke over the East River, and the living room glowed with gentle light. My heaving sobs and tears had stopped by then. I lay there, very still, until the bedroom door clicked open. Krishna shuffled out and stopped, blinking.
Mommy, I'm scared,
she said, the first time she had ever used that word. I stood up, took her in my arms, and held her, thinking, but never saying, me too. I ached for him now, for his dashing man smell, for his booming voice as he called out to me as I primped in front of the mirror.
Hurry up now, Junior. We haven't got all day.
Indeed, we hadn't had enough time at all. Chapter 17. The world had changed. It had dimmed. It was as if my eyes had been traded for some other lenses. Ones with a darker filter through which less light got through. I was fine with this. I wrapped my grief around me like a cloak. I took comfort in it. I went out into the sunlight of the outside world only when my work or Krishna required it. I focused on just three things: Krishna, work, and Teddy being gone. He had entered my life and in so doing had altered it completely and ineradicably, and now his death, his exit, altered it anew. My cocoon of grief became so familiar to me, so safe, so cozy, that I did not want to venture out.
This is how life will be, I thought. In January of 2012, less than 2 months after Teddy's death, I would enter the Supreme Court of the state of New York for the first day of the custody trial. I was on autopilot. There were opening statements. A couple of observers sat in the back of the courtroom listening. And then I took the stand. I remember thinking how shiny Adam's shoes looked, how big his feet appeared under the table he sat at with his lawyers. My attorneys had prepared me by instructing me to be concise in my answers and to tell the truth. Answer only the question asked of you. Do not get rattled by the other side, they had warned. I felt as if nothing could rattle me again. After 2 hours of questioning, we broke for lunch. The Dell lawyers had done their best to find some fault with my parenting in their opening statement, and realized, I guess, that they could not after I took the stand. And so Adam's side asked for a recess over the weekend to negotiate out of court. I was never cross-examined, and Adam would not take the stand. By that Monday, we reached a settlement. I walked away numb, but with no significant change to what was in place before the litigation. In the end, Krishna's last name would be hyphenated to include Adam's surname. She would now be called Krishnathaya Lakshmi, Dell. A small price to pay for an end to a meaningless and expensive anguish. That March, Krishna and I went to the Hamptons house for the last time to say goodbye to the place that Teddy and we had been the happiest, and to bring home what tangible memories we could. I bent down in the driveway and filled a Ziploc bag with the pebbles he drove over by the tennis courts. I wanted anything he had touched, the cracked wood canister by his bedside that held his pens and pencils, the clay bowl in our dressing room he threw his golf gloves and extra tees into when he came home. I had coveted his comb and the Guerlain cologne and deodorant that Maggie Sweetly had rescued for me from his medicine cabinet right after his death. I could not stop the voracious appetite I had for my lover's things, and they somehow had magnified meaning now, because I could not find meaning in his being gone. The year or so that followed Teddy's passing, I spent in a walking daze, focusing on Krishna and her ever-changing needs. My friends and family came together around us and did their best to comfort me and keep me busy. But mostly, I was engulfed in my own private universe, going to work when required, and otherwise just being with Krishna. She was great company and succor to my grief. She also slept with me, just as I had slept with Neela back in India. This gave me an enormous sense of physical well-being. I didn't date, couldn't imagine or consider it really. I didn't feel like I was single, just that my lover happened to be dead. I felt like Teddy was very much still with me. Krishna was my sole source of bodily contact, and that was more than fine. I couldn't fathom having any man close to me, and I returned to an almost childlike, prepubescent state. My sexuality was non-existent, and that was actually liberating. On the weekends when Krishna went to Adam's, I relished being alone, rattling around the house, talking out loud to Teddy like some crazy old lady, and luxuriating in the peace and quiet. So much had happened that I was psychically exhausted. I couldn't re-enter life as others knew it, but I was trying. When Neela told me that her younger daughter, Akshara, was getting married, I knew I had to find the wherewithal to push through my self-imposed hermitism. The wedding would be on Valentine's Day, 2013. February 14th has always been a special day in our family. It was Neela's birthday. This year she would turn 50. It was also the day after Teddy's birthday, so it had become dark for me after he died. I was happy that it would now represent another joyous occasion, a new beginning for Akshara and Ravi, her husband-to-be. In our family, we call each other not only on birthdays, but also on anniversaries. I was happy to add the date to my calendar, knowing that from then on, I'd have yet another reason to express my love to the people who meant the most to me. India was the perfect salve to my wounds. Krishna was a great traveler. Over the few short years of her life, she had clocked more miles than most adults. Her disposition was easy and pleasant, and she had the uncanny ability to amuse herself on planes while I dozed and read. It was astonishing. She had been to Chennai before, but this would be the first time she'd actually remember it. We arrived from New York after a day-long slog through airports and planes and traffic. It was 10 p.m. local time, but my body had no idea if it was night or day. Krishna was hungry, so I found some leftover dosa batter in the kitchen and started making one for her. Next thing I knew, my grandmother was by my side, commandeering the griddle. "Let me do it," she said. "You don't know where anything is." I insisted, but she won, even though by then she cooked with only one arm, the other still paralyzed from the stroke long ago. Then my Aunt Papu came in and yelped, "Yay, you're making your grandmother cook?" She was appalled. "It's 10 at night. Papu took over. My grandmother wouldn't leave, and then my Uncle Ravi entered the fray. "Look at you," he said. "You're supposed to be this famous food person, and you're making these women cook at 10 o'clock? I quickly remembered how it felt to live with so many people. Every move you make is scrutinized. You get up, and it's, "Where are you going?" You come back, and it's, "Why are you wearing that blouse? I like the other one better." You walk outside, and someone calls from the veranda, "Don't go that way. There's too much sun." It was exasperating and suffocating, and God, I had missed it. The year before, my success had allowed me to move Neela and my grandmother out of our childhood home to a larger, newer place. By my calculations, I still owed them much more. This larger, three-bedroom apartment, still in Besanagar but on a quieter, tree-lined street, had a night watchman at the entrance of the complex. Not only did I want to be more comfortable whenever I visited, but the old flat in Besantnagar, which was to become the site of Neela's sari and blouse-making operation, needed repairs. The plumbing, electrical wiring, kitchen, and bathrooms in that house were much the same as when I was in third grade. The city of Chennai itself, however, was much different from what it was when I had built sand temples in the neighborhood. The city, that had felt in many ways like a sleepy town, had become a frenetic metropolis. Much of the sand was now asphalt. St. Michael's Academy had expanded into a large compound with tall buildings and fields for soccer and cricket. The milk bar, that was once a leafy oasis, was now a seedy, dilapidated place to be avoided. Neela and I visited the old flat. All around our old building, urban development now made the area feel very congested. We could no longer see the ocean from my grandfather's bedroom window. Taller buildings had been erected all around. Everyone wanted to live near the sea. The courtyard below had been asphalted, too. Children no longer made temples in the sand. I couldn't believe how small the place looked. It had always felt so huge to me. I visited each room, could still see the lizards where the cracked walls met the ceiling. The place was empty save for a few sewing machines and tailors, employees of Neela's business. So many of us had grown up here, fought as children here, cried as teenagers, and often run back to this place as adults. Several sewing machines hummed as I walked barefoot on the old green marble from room to room. Underneath the hum, I could still hear echoes of Rajini tattling on me to Banu, the screech of my grandfather's metal desk chair as he rose to say goodbye to a student. The house had never been beautiful, but it was beautiful to me, even in its run-down and empty state. Yet for all the changes, Much felt the same in the new apartment. There were still buckets of hot water for bathing, in spite of showerheads being installed in these new bathrooms. There were still far too many of us, old and young, from my grandmother to Krishna. We would crowd onto the floor, draping ourselves on pillows, grooming and feeding like a troop of monkeys, me scratching my nephew Siddhant's back, Neela braiding my hair, kids climbing among our bodies, Aunt Banu kneeling on the ground, peeling potatoes or mangoes, my grandmother haggling with every vendor she came across on the porch below. And we still talked, a lot. Our conversations were a blur of languages. Everyone in the household was tri or even quadrilingual. I grew up speaking Tamil, the language of my ethnicity, Hindi, the national language, but also the language of Delhi, and English. Others in my family added Malayalam, the language of Kerala, my ancestral home, to that list. Please and okay were in English and bookended by many bursts of speech. Please, someone might begin, then switch to Hindi. Could you make some chai for me? Then, without skipping a beat, she might continue in Tamil. I'm really craving it. Then back to English. Okay? Certain words were just better in one language than another. And still, just as soon as the plates from lunch were cleared, we talked about what we might have for dinner. When tiffin time came, my grandmother and Neela still disappeared into the kitchen to short-order cook dosa, bringing them to us as they were ready, our greed and impatience scorching our fingers as we tore apart the crepes. We still walked on Elliot's beach, and as we turned back toward home, we still had to make the old heart-wrenching decision whether to stay in for dinner or to go out for chaat. The new place had cool marble floors too, though not speckled green, but glossy beige. Each bedroom had its own veranda and bathroom, one for my grandma, one for Neela, and one for Krishna and me when we came. Still, because of the wedding, we managed to fill every square inch of floor with out-of-town relatives. As lovely as Krishna had been on the plane, she was now in as foul a mood. At home in the East Village, it was usually just the two of us. My mother and Peter came to visit once every other month. Here, it seemed to her, people were pouring in from every corner. She was a novelty to most our extended relatives, many of whom hadn't met her yet. The idea of personal space in India does not extend to children. Total strangers would come up to her and pinch her cheeks or squeeze her nose. Her soft, pale white skin was just too tempting not to touch, as was her soft, light brown hair, which fell in short ringlets around her face like Shirley Temple's.
"You are so cute, Krishnakuti,"
they wailed in their thick accents as they tried to engage her.
"Stop touching me," she wailed back.
Krishna was pissed. She struggled to find an unpopulated corner of the house. I had to speak to her about respecting her elders. But at age 3, the cultural differences were hard for her to adapt to. I wondered then if Krishna would have the same connection to family that I did, with all of us cousins functioning more like siblings. It was the love and support of all these people that had seen me through the various tumults of my life. Suddenly, in the middle of my family, who practically knew me better than I knew myself, I began to miss Teddy terribly. Coming here had been good. It had woken me up from my grief-stricken stupor, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something was missing. It was Teddy. Teddy should have been there with me, in that place I considered home. Teddy had shown me so much. Teddy had taught me about unconditional love and forgiveness. I could hear his voice in my head as I looked at the floor, trying to find a place to sit.
"This is the only game in town, Junior. Big tribe. Everyone should be so lucky."
So, when I received a letter from Adam the following Christmas, at the end of 2013, it was Teddy I thought of the forgiveness he had shown me, and of the way he had loved Krishna, how he had placed her and my well-being above his own hurt and pain. It had been almost 2 years since I had taken the stand in the Supreme Court of the state of New York, since Adam and I had reached our custody settlement. Since then, he had been a consistent, present, and loving father to Krishna. He had hardly missed a day of his time with her, and I could see how much Krishna had blossomed under the warmth of his love. He took great and enthusiastic care with anything related to her. I didn't spend much time in his company, but I knew my child enough to see that her well-being was also due to him. I tried to focus on that. It was what counted now anyway. Adam's letter was long, 5 pages, handwritten in his minuscule chicken scrawl, about 8 pages in human penmanship. In it, he covered many topics. He spoke of his love for Krishna, thanked me for being a good mother, apologized for the lawsuit and for hurting me, and he wrote of how much he enjoyed being a father. I wasn't sure I believed everything in there, but I didn't doubt for a moment his love for Krishna. The letter softened me. I could appreciate the courage it must have taken to write it. For 2 years, Adam had tried to get various messages to me through mutual friends. Every once in a while, he'd invite me for a drink or dinner via text or email. I always declined. In those days, my housekeeper or I would bring Krishna down to the lobby rather than allow Adam up the elevator to come to our front door. His main sources of information about me were Tara's husband Matt, who knew him well from before, and my mother, who kept an occasional telephonic contact with him. Matt tried to lobby for Adam, feeling that he had changed a lot after becoming a dad. I told Matt that if Adam had anything to say, he should write me a letter and not pass messages as if he were in high school. And so I had received this magnum opus of a letter. I gingerly answered the letter and thanked him for his olive branch and apologies. But it would take time, I wrote back. The following February, in 2014, his mother passed away after a long battle with cancer. I knew Adam was grieving. For some time, Adam had been asking if I would join him and Krishna for dinner at his house. It seemed like a yes for me could be my first olive branch, and that perhaps the three of us being together, even if it was awkward and tentative, might do some small part to maybe ease his grief. I could hardly say no. Krishna was ecstatic to have both her parents in the same room. After the success of that first dinner, Adam invited me the following month to an Ides of March dinner. He and Krishna were going to make homemade pizzas and dress as Romans in togas. Again, I said yes, remembering how much joy it would bring Krishna. I dressed up in my old Princess Bithya costume from the Ten Commandments miniseries I had filmed years before. Adam insisted we had to immortalize the night. Our costumes were just too good not to get a photo of. I sat stiffly and nervously on the couch, Krishna between us, while his housekeeper took a photo. We all looked quite splendid in our ridiculous family portrait. The Ides of March dinner marked a turning point for Adam and me. It wasn't 180-degree about-face, but more like a gentle bend in the road. But from that point forward, Adam, Krishna, and I had a monthly get-together. We agreed Krishna needed to see her parents get along. We both felt it was important for her to feel we were sharing notes, informing each other of her life, communicating. She was 4 by then, sharp and keenly observant. Over the course of that year, we lurched forward bit by bit, month by month. My chill, though not my caution, toward Adam began to thaw. As Christmas approached, Krishna decided she desperately wanted our monthly outing to be ice skating at Rockefeller Center, followed by seeing the larger-than-life tree. This from a kid with one Hindu and one Jewish parent. Until then, all of our monthly get-togethers had happened in private. so going to Rockefeller Center at the height of the holiday season made me queasy at best. I had grown up in New York, too, just like Krishna, however different our lives may otherwise have been. And I remembered acutely how special an occasion it was to go ice skating at Rockefeller Center. My mother could rarely afford it. The skate rentals were so costly. It was a memory I wanted to make with Krishna, as I had made it with my own mother. I couldn't resist and agreed to go. That chilly Saturday, Krishna and I arrived at Rockefeller Center close to 6. We had just gotten out of a matinee of the movie Annie, emerging into a dark winter night. Christmas was just around the corner, and Rockefeller Center was bursting with holiday shoppers, out-of-town tourists, and Salvation Army Santas ringing the bells. Glittering wreaths and tinsel garlands adorned the shop fronts, and their display windows were done up to the nines, functioning as elaborate holiday dioramas, toy trains circling miniature tracks that traverse snow-sparkling miniature villages of dazzlingly complex detail. It was hard to find space to maneuver on the sidewalk. I had recently acquired a highly impractical, extremely puffy, red goat hair coat that made the upper half of my body look like a giant cranberry snowball. So it was hard to even carry Krishna in my arms. She was almost 5 and getting heavier every day. My baby wasn't really a baby anymore. The air was bitingly cold, so much so that you needed a hat and gloves to be comfortable outside for any length of time. It pricked our faces, though we ignored this by keeping ourselves moving. The minute I caught sight of the glass elevator at the entrance to Rockefeller Center, I instantly smelled the undeniable aroma of roasting chestnuts blackened on iron skillets by the seasonal street vendors. The scent had always heralded the holidays for me and my mother. Though ice skating trips were expensive, and my mother herself could not ice skate, she often stood at the edge of the rink and watched me skate alone. Part of what we loved about making the excursion were those delicious roasted chestnuts. We loved the earthy smell of them, the acrid whiff of char combined with the sweetness of the nut meat. We relished holding the hot little stones in our hands, then stuffing our pockets with the crinkly paper bags of nuts, which functioned as impromptu hand warmers, pulling out one chestnut at a time and peeling it gingerly, the released steam stinging our naked fingers. We loved the charred, chewy outer parts and the steaming, soft, almost buttery centers, too. Our Rockefeller Center outings were actually almost entirely an excuse to indulge in this wintertime delicacy. Standing there 35 years later, the scent instantly transported me to being 9 years old again. I wished I could somehow harness the aroma and mail an envelope of it to my mother in California, who was right then probably trimming the roses in her sun-filled front yard. I looked up at the night sky. High above, all the national flags flapping vigorously in the winter wind, as well as the larger-than-life toy soldiers, the great Christmas tree towered above everything, twinkly and imposing. I pointed it out to Krishna, who was far more enchanted with the statue of Prometheus at its base. Below the golden Titan lay the ice rink, shimmering and impossibly white, crowded by holiday revelers, crisscrossing it in loops and twirls. We waited there for Adam to meet us and take us to the VIP entrance, which until recently I hadn't even known existed. Adam had generously paid extra, so we would not have to wait in line. He knew about my aversion to crowds, and I appreciated this added luxury. Adam emerged from the sea of people on the plaza. He was tall and easy to see. He grabbed Krishna and swiftly put her up on his shoulders above the crowd. Her face lit up as bright as the big tree. He waited in line for the elevator, and he put her down as we went in. Once downstairs in the shopping arcade, we went into the small VIP area to get our skates, joining a couple of other families there. Beyond the doors, I saw a steady stream of skaters, all in a bunch, going around and around the rink, like a school of fish. How were we going to wade into that? Adam helped Krishna with her tiny rental skates, and I somehow managed to bend over and get mine on in spite of the puffball coat. A man helping his own daughter and son with their skates smiled at Adam and Krishna and said, "What a lovely child." "Thank you," Adam and I both responded in unison. We looked at each other and I smiled sheepishly, but also couldn't help but feel territorial. It was a rare and strange occurrence for us to experience the feeling of joint parental pride. "You ready, Mommy?" Krishna asked. I nodded silently as Adam led her to the entrance of the rink. He patiently helped her walk on her skates. She looked so small next to him. Beyond their silhouettes, I could see the people, the steady stream of skaters. I hurried and went out ahead, onto the ice first. I was a better skater than either of them, and held on to the rink wall. I needed some air. The spectators looking down from above made me feel like I was in a Roman amphitheater. A knot of teenagers whizzed by, followed by a young couple holding hands, going slowly and trying to steady themselves. An elderly woman and a young man who looked like her grandson glided by, arm in arm. They looked like they had been skating all their lives. I thought then about my future 70-year-old self, bringing Krishna's son or daughter to this very place my mother had first brought me. There were families of all sorts of sizes and colors. In the middle of the rink twirled skaters who looked almost semi-professional, dressed in lighter skating costumes, elegant cloth covers over their own skates. They pirouetted and glided with swan-like elegance, and the other average skaters falling and tripping behind them in the far curve of the rink made for a comical backdrop. The spirit of the crowd took me out of my own anxiety. Everyone was so happy. Everyone was smiling. But no two smiles were bigger than Krishna's and her dad's. You could see her two little dimples piercing deep into her chin, just under her upturned rosy lips, pressing tightly together. Her cheeks looked like they would burst. "You ready, Mommy?" Adam repeated. I took a deep breath. We started out very slowly on the ice, Krishna in the middle, holding each of our hands. Since none of us were that steady, we stayed on the outer perimeter, going very slowly. We were new at this, all of it. It felt dangerous, like the ice was thin and might break open at any moment and swallow us whole. But the ground did not open up. Ahead of us, I saw a couple of kids tumble and fall, but get up instantly before we reached them. They skated onward like nothing had happened. I glanced down at Krishna, who was having some trouble staying upright on her skates. But she hung in there, joyful and excited. We went around a few times and got the hang of it, more or less. The three of us managed to stay vertical, as well as dodge those who fell in our path. Little by little, we gained our confidence. We picked up speed, too. This was the challenge we had been working up to all these many months. It felt exhilarating to be gliding on that ice, the three of us together, holding hands. I even felt brave enough to let go of Krishna's hand and skate backward, briefly, facing Adam and our daughter. Years of skating in the city came back to my legs. The rink was too busy to do it for very long, but I was glad I had taken the risk. I asked them if they wanted to stop and take a break. Adam looked at me and smiled. "No, are you kidding?" he said. "I want hot chocolate. I want cookies," Krishna pleaded. We skated around a bit more and then went back into the rental area for a break. As we sat back in the warmth and had our snacks, I thought about where I would be in my life the next time I came to this rink. Being here had always been a special occasion, a treat to be savored, remembered. On no occasion was this more so than that evening. The baby was getting older. We had done a pretty good job of maintaining a civil, polite rapport between us, at least in front of her, even through the worst of it. We had been successfully following through on our monthly get-togethers so Krishna could experience the feeling of having her family together. But it was Adam who had been the driving force behind the idea. The dinner